The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
It's the story of your life. You're moving down the page, and you know you're on your way. The story of the
morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt on the third day of May in the year of our Lord 2023. I'm inside the Beltway where a beautiful spring has broken out, but sadly the news from around the world is awful as it is good in the United States. From the BBC comes a story, COVID-19 in India. Cases, death, and oxygen supply. There have been a record number of deaths. Their daily death total is now surging towards 4,000 on some days. It's well over 3,000 most day. There are very few critical care beds in India. Chronic shortage of space in the intensive care wards in Delhi, a region of about 20 million people. Hospitals are full and turning away patients. Doctors have described how people are dying in the streets outside of hospitals. There's a shortage of oxygen across the entire country. And train carriages have become medical wards. About 4,000 Indian railway coaches have been converted into pandemic treatment centers, but still they struggle for space. Sports halls and stadiums have become hospitals, and crematoriums are organizing mass funeral pyres because there are simply too many dead for them to handle. The BBC ran with a story from inside of a Delhi hotel, which I'll play you a clip of. It's a complete nightmare. Stories from inside India's COVID disaster from the Financial Times. India is in the throes of one of its darkest moments since independence as a catastrophic second COVID-19 wave tears through it with dizzying speed. The country recorded an all-time high of more than 386,000 new cases on Thursday, along with more than 3,500 deaths. From the Wall Street Journal, India's COVID calamity has sick caring for the sicker. I'm alone to save my family. Instead of a wedding, a bride-to-be scours a hard-hit city for oxygen and hospital beds to rescue her father and grandfather before it's too late. Team Biden says they are doing all they can do to help India, but the ambiguity on yesterday's Sunday show was studied. They simply do not want to waive patent protection for the vaccines. I'm not sure why not. Legacy media is still in the honeymoon phase, which I understand. Their 100 days is over, but it'll probably be 500 days before we get over it with the legacy media and the Biden administration. But all of their officials, Ron Klain and Jake Sullivan, who are as close to the top, they are the top, actually, would not answer the question except with expressions of concern and promises of aid. But the specific relief that Prime Minister Modi has asked for is to waive patent protection to allow them to take the patents of the two U.S.-baked Operation Warp Speed subsidized vaccines and produce them themselves. We have offered them all of our AstraZeneca permitted resources. They're not sitting in a warehouse anywhere, but Biden officials say that despite the calls, vaccine patents were only part of the problem, that manufacturing limits would still hinder production. India has its own vaccine, said Ron Klain, the Covishield vaccine. Production is slow because they don't have the scarce raw materials to make that. Intellectual property rights is part of the problem, but manufacturing is the biggest problem. You see, that's a deflection. That's a deflection. Bernie Sanders got asked the same thing on, I think it was Meet the Press, and he blamed Trump, which is pretty sad at this point. Meanwhile, the tears continue in Israel where the Maron tragedy, the Israeli religious festival that saw 45 Israelis crushed to death, many more injured, continues to rack the country with grief. Venezuela is another scene of desperation as Maduro's corrupt, horrific rule has resulted in a COVID disaster every bit as bad as India's, but we can't cover it because it's a totalitarian state. And from the Washington Post, it's all Taliban country now. New militant checkpoints on key roadways choke off parts of Afghanistan. And, of course, as we withdraw, the Afghan army withdraws and the Afghan National Police Force withdraws, and large swathes of Afghan's rural territory, according to Susanna George, Aziz Tazal, and Sharif Hassan, are now spilling over into the roadways which connect urban centers. Never a very good strategy to hold the urban centers, but not the countryside, because you got to go eventually. Most government officials are now flying between cities. They dare not drive because Taliban toll checkpoints are springing up everywhere. In the United States, I've got a new Washington Post op-ed, which is drawing the ire of the left because it simply remarks upon the five GOP hopefuls that I have in the top tier. It's season one of the hunt for a red November. That's what I call the four-year competition, the hunt for red November. And season one is a third of the way through, 2021, and 4 months for the Steelers fans out there. And there are five people on top, and you can read that column over at WashingtonPost.com. It's on the front page, or you can just Google Hugh Hewitt and Washington Post and look for five GOP hopefuls. I'll come back to it. The key big domestic story is the stock market. From the Wall Street Journal, Americans can't get enough of the stock market. Americans are all in on the stock market. Individual investors are holding more stocks than ever before as major indexes climb to fresh highs. They're also upping the ante by borrowing, bad idea, to magnify their bets or increasingly buying on small dips in the market. From Apple's to Domino's Pizza, U.S. companies scramble to meet surge in demand. Okay, demand, this follows in a sequence. First of all, Americans are buying stocks like they've never bought them before. Then we get a Wall Street Journal story that everything, consumers are splurging on cars and furniture, facing extended waits for delivery. Restaurants and gyms are reopening and struggling to find workers. Factories and home builders are trying to ramp up but are short on semiconductors or raw materials. Okay, that's just giant supply problems from gadget giant Apple to mattress seller Tempur Sealy International. And last week's supply chain issues curbing the growth of things like Ford Motor. That suggests people are buying everything that can be bought. And we have record lumber prices are lifting sawmills at the same time that homeowners and do-it-yourselfers are paying a higher price. Look, I had to go and buy some pressure-treated 2x4s. Now, they normally run me about $6, but they're up to $12. And pressure-treated 4x4 posts, you know, if I'm building a fence for Dwayne, got a backyard back there, and I'm putting in the fence post. And pressure-treated means it's simply you can put it in the ground, it's not going to rot. Something I had to teach Dwayne about this weekend. Normally they go for about $15 or $25. I mean, Dwayne's backyard is becoming like Gallagher Studios, palatial. And it's because of this story in the Wall Street Journal, record lumber prices. Waiting for wood may not help. Mill owners say they are backed up with orders into June. Boards for July delivery, the most actively traded futures contract, ended Friday at 1,376. September lumber costs $1,235. Absent a significant increase in mortgage rates or a COVID resurgence, hard to imagine what could cause lumber demand to drop and prices to moderate in the foreseeable future, said the chief executive of Poultice Deltic Corp, which owns timberland and mills in Idaho, Arkansas, Michigan, and Minnesota. meanwhile, the political story came out of Texas. Democrats tried very hard to pick up a House seat in Texas where Ron Wright died, and they had an open primary, and Susan Wright won, and she will face Representative Jake Elzey, who is also a Republican. Democrats threw a lot of money at Jana Lynn Sanchez, who came in third. Sorry, you don't make it. Third place doesn't even get a horseshoe award. It's not close. And so that seat is not going to get flipped. Warren Buffett, meanwhile, told his investors he sees, quote, significant inflation amid a, quote, red-hot U.S. recovery. Bitcoin, you never like to see the, I don't touch Bitcoin. I don't understand it well enough to touch it and only buy what you know. Bitcoin, too good to miss or a bubble ready to burst? Whenever you see bubble in the same headline as a commodity being traded, in this case, Bitcoin, run away. And Janet Yellen was out arguing that we need higher taxes. It is simply not believable that she did so. Meanwhile, remote work is killing Manhattan storefronts. And in Southlake, Texas, a small city north of Dallas, they just routed a diversity curriculum. Critical race theory suffered its biggest defeat ever. There's lots more news on this Monday. I'll cover it all when we return to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm a little bit sore. I'm going to take my relief factor later after working in Dwayne's backyard all weekend. That lumber, though, that bill was something else. We found the BBC package on India. As I said, I don't think I've actually seen anything like this in my life. I knew about of course, America experienced 9/11. That's 3,000 dead people. They're having a 9/11 a day in India, but it's spread out. And the United States went through some horrific days last spring, and generally our hospitals never reached the point where they turned anyone away, except maybe in New York City. And I don't think we ever ran out of oxygen early on in the crisis. We thought we needed more ventilators until we decided therapeutically they weren't very useful, except in extreme cases. So we never reached anything like India is experiencing. Let's roll the BBC clip.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is under intense pressure to announce a national lockdown after India reported the highest number of deaths with COVID-19 over a 24-hour period. Mr. Modi had resisted the measure in the build-up to regional elections where his party is trying to extend its influence. But with the polls now over, the Prime Minister has been meeting senior officials to review the situation. Our correspondent Davina Gupta is in Delhi.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in his last address with the public when the regional polls were going on, had stopped short of announcing a national lockdown, saying it's up to the states to decide whether they want to have a mini lockdown and it should only be used as a last resort because livelihoods of a lot of people in India, almost 90% of the workforce, which is in the informal sector, is dependent on odd jobs and daily wages that they get in various states. And if there's a lockdown, then what happens to those people? We've seen a migrant crisis where a majority of the migrants staying in the cities has walked back to their homes without any transport, at least in the first month of the lockdown. There were reports of how many people walked on foot and also experienced fatigue. And that's the situation that the government wants to avoid at the moment. But experts say it's just a race against time. The extent of the pandemic right now is quite different from last year. We're seeing more a record number of deaths, over 3,600 being reported, record number of cases, over 400,000 reported across the country earlier this week. And these are the numbers that require bold, decisive steps. And national lockdown could be the way of dealing with this crisis at the moment to save as many lives as possible.
And what about the politics? Because obviously we've seen those polls open and close. What is the expected impact, if it's possible to judge at this stage, on the Prime Minister?
The politics really don't interest me. What interests me is Modi suffered some loss in Bengal, I believe. They had some local elections, like an off-year governor election here in the United States. But it's just a level of horrific suffering. Welcome back, America. As I just tweeted out, the Virginia GOP distributed convention, that means remote voting in the GOP convention, is this coming Saturday. Glenn Youngkin is the candidate that I will be casting my vote for, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Glenn. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Tell me about how your weekend went and how you're feeling about next Saturday. And, of course, remind everyone how they actually vote in a distributed convention.
Well, we had a great weekend. We've been all over Virginia meeting with voters. We've had really big crowds everywhere we're going. And then, of course, yesterday, Senator Ted Cruz endorsed me, and he'll be on the road with me this week campaigning. And to vote this week, and it's going to be crowded, folks. So I just ask everybody to be patient. But on Saturday, you'll drive up to your polling location. You can find it at my website, which is youngkinforgovernor.com. You can find out where to go. You got to be there between 9 and 4. Do not be late. You'll get a ranked order choice ballot, and I would just humbly ask everyone to consider putting me down as their first choice, please.
And I know you won't say this because it's not good form, but I'm a radio talk show host, so I can say this. I'm only going to vote for Glenn Youngkin. I'm not going to have a second choice because I actually, there's some nice people running, but I don't think they can beat Terry McAuliffe. And Glenn, tell us why you think you can beat Terry McAuliffe in the fall.
Well, I've got a business experience like nobody else in this race, a 30-year career, and I think really at the end of the day, it's how we're going to manage this great Commonwealth as it comes out of the pandemic and create jobs and get this economy moving, but also how we're going to get things done. And my career actually demonstrated to me and to others that the goal here is not to make empty promises, but to actually get deliverables finished. And that's what I'm all about. And I don't believe anybody on the Republican side nor the Democrat side has that kind of credential. I also think that the key here is, in fact, beating Terry. And we must win in order to get our Commonwealth back. And we're running a campaign like nobody else is running, like no Republican governor has ever run. And that's what it's going to take in order to win in November. And that's why we're going to win in November, is because of the quality and intensity of the campaign we're running.
Now, Glenn Youngkin, I'm on in Bristol, Virginia, which is split between Tennessee and Virginia, the city of Bristol. I'm on in the Shenandoah Valley. I'm down in Norfolk and Virginia Beach, and of course, most heavily in the Beltway. Virginia is a state, and most of the country won't know this, of many different states, many different regions. Where are you running strongest in the Republican Party? If you've got Ted Cruz with you, that's really going to play in Lynchburg and down south and out in the western part of the state. But are you stronger in the Beltway because you're close to the Beltway in your professional career?
We're strong everywhere. It's been amazing. I've traveled well over 20,000 miles in the last 14 weeks. And in fact, we're in Bristol in Southwest Virginia here on Monday. And we're going to be up into the valley on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then down into Hampton Roads on Thursday, and then back up through Richmond and Northern Virginia Thursday afternoon and Friday. So we're going to be everywhere this week, touching polling locations and talking to voters. And so we've seen strength everywhere, and that has been humbling and incredibly encouraging. Republicans are ready for a different kind of leader. We're coming together like never before, whether I'm at a libertarian breakfast or a Tea Party lunch or with a group of forever Trumpers or a smaller group of never Trumpers or single issue voters. Republicans are coming together and saying we must have a different path forward for our great Commonwealth. And I've been so encouraged by the level of support all over Virginia.
You know, my friend Selena Zito has written a column from Bristol because on the Tennessee side of the line, it's thriving. And on the Virginia side of the line, not so much, because, of course, Ralph Northam has mismanaged the opening and closing of Virginia. Do you see beyond the school putting math back to those who can do math, but do you see a shakeup top to bottom in the Commonwealth of Virginia under Youngkin?
I see a shakeup top to bottom. The first thing we're going to do on day one is get open. We're going to open schools, open businesses, open houses of worship. We're going to roll back the amazing layer of red tape and bureaucracy that's been put on top of Virginia businesses. We've got to get moving. And you just called it perfectly. You got one part of Bristol that is open and moving and another part of Bristol that is not because of what Ralph Northam has done. And so we're just going to get going. I think this is about leadership. And I think this is about understanding that we have to get the economy open, our schools open in order to compete. You know, Virginians over the last few years, in fact, have moved away to Tennessee, North Carolina, Florida, and Georgia, and South Carolina, and Texas at a much higher rate than people have moved to Virginia from the other 49 states. And the primary reason has been our economy has lagged. The cost of living is too high. And here we have a governor that's made it even worse. I mean, at one point, Virginia was ranked 50th on a freedom index based on what this governor has done in keeping things shut. So we're going to get open and we're going to get moving.
Well, Glenn Youngkin, we'll talk to you again on Friday to remind people. I know you've got a very sophisticated online operation, so you'll be reminding people who registered to be delegates, including me and the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, 9 to 4 on Saturday. Don't be late. Be early. Only in Hugh Hewitt's view, just write down Glenn Youngkin and nobody else, and get through that line and stay in that line till you vote. Don't give up because you got errands to do. This matters to the future of Virginia. Glenn Youngkin, thank you. We'll talk to you again on Friday to help remind people. Very important early test. I'll talk to Steve Kornacki about this race a little bit later this morning on Monday. Don't go anywhere, America. Hour number two of the Hugh Hewitt Show is straight ahead. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. On Monday, May the 3rd in the year of our Lord 2021, I will tell you that Jim Garrity is coming up later in the hour. And as a Jets fan, his Super Bowl was over the weekend, the NFL draft. I know that feeling. For many years, the Browns Super Bowl was the NFL draft. But now we just looked at it as we're filling in pieces of our Super Bowl team. I'm joined by Jake Sherman, who I do not know if he roots for the Jets or the Washington Football Club. Jake Sherman is a Punch Bowl News editor-in-chief. You should get their morning newsletter, which is in front of me, from punchbowlnews.com. What are you, Jake? Are you a Redskins, Washington Football Club fan?
I grew up a Jets fan because that's what my dad was.
Ooh.
Now I know. But listen, I am agnostic about the NFL, to be honest with you. And I know that's kind of like sacrilege as an American, but I have enough on my mind with the Nationals and my GW Colonials basketball team that I don't have room for anybody else in my heart right now.
Oh, you're a Colonials guy. You know, I went to church yesterday, and for the first time, I had a political conversation at my church in the Beltway. A fellow was wearing a Nationals mask, and he came over to talk to me and said, you know, we don't agree on much, but we agree on Major League Baseball really stepped in it with their moving of the All-Star game. And we talked a bit about that. I won't go to a game this year because of that. Commissioner Manfred is the worst commissioner in my memory, and we've had some bad ones. What is the data on that, other than the poll from our friends at Axios that showed Major League Baseball's favorability plummeting with Republicans after that bonehead move?
You know, I don't know. I don't know what the long-term impacts of it are. I don't know. I mean, I know that clearly they've upset the business community in Atlanta, which was expecting a large-scale infusion of human beings for their businesses. But you know, I've been saying this for a long time. I think that large newspapers, and I'm able to say this because I'm no longer at a large news organization, should probably devote somebody, a reporter full time, to deal with politics and sports. I know people say they want politics out of their sports, but it's they're inextricable at this point. I mean, every single league has political issues all the time, and it should be covered because these are multi-billion-dollar industries.
Did you hear Roger Goodell announced during the NFL draft? Maybe you're not an NFL guy, but 30 million people watched the draft on Thursday night. That's bigger than the GOP debates in which I participated. It's bigger than any television event. It's three times the early number for the Oscars. I gather they upgraded it. Okay, it's a sports show, and it was not political, Jake. That's why it was great. It's just young men achieving their dreams and lots of schmaltz. I mean, it's just a schmaltz fest. But it was great. It was terrific. Let's get to the Punch Bowl newsletter, because I have a column in the Washington Post this morning about what I call season one in the hunt for a red November, which is the GOP presidential nomination. I've identified five in the top tier, but the Punch Bowl begins with someone who I don't think is in tier one yet. May not get there. Marco Rubio. Why did you profile Marco Rubio in the third installment of What Do They Want? What I call the hunt for red November, you call What Do They Want?
Yeah, you know, we've done Karen Bass and Jim Jordan, two very big up-and-comers. Obviously, Jordan's not an up-and-comer, and Bass is already established, so maybe neither of them are up-and-comers, but big figures in Congress. What we try to do is we try to strip everything down to its core. What do they want, meaning what are they aiming for? What do they want next in their career? And Marco Rubio is at a crossroads of sorts. I mean, he has a big Senate race next year, a Senate race that he's probably a pretty heavy favorite in this point, in a state that I think, as you and I have talked about, he is trending more and more red as the years go on. But will he run for president in 2024? Will he run for Senate Republican leadership, where he'd be an interesting candidate for a lot of people? And he's not shown that he's terribly interested in the leadership track in the Senate, but it is a viable option for him.
Oh, sure it is. Now, Ruthless Podcast, do you listen to that, since it's the millennial choice?
I do.
And so, you know, they refer to the free state of Florida. Smug and Josh Holmes refer to the free state of Florida, which it's becoming the new Texas. Florida is the new Texas, the place to which Republicans retreat and reestablish defensible lines and then move out again with DeSantis. How do the big three in Florida get along? Ron DeSantis, Rick Scott, and Marco Rubio.
I think there's a lot of tension there, to be honest with you. I think that, I think they're three. I don't want to say anything out of school without having, you know, run it down accurately and reporting it. So I just want to be careful what I say. But listen, I mean, there's obviously a lot of tension. Rick Scott was a governor, right? And Ron DeSantis is the governor. Ron DeSantis came out from the House of Representatives, became governor. So and he's gotten a lot of plaudits and some criticism along the way in his handling of the coronavirus. But he's certainly got the attention of a lot of people. And it is, I mean, I don't think there's any other state in America you could correct me that has a trio like that in one party, three statewide elected officials that are just so in such, you know, heavy limelight. I would say they're probably the only three.
I mean, it may be the best represented state in terms of national talent. All three are very talented individuals. Two governors, one two-time senator and a former House of Representatives in Florida speaker. They know what they're doing. And Marco is so eloquent, and Rick Scott is doggedly on message, and Ron DeSantis knows how to be combative constructively. It's going to be quite a remarkable. So I want to turn with you to my Hunt for Red November column, Jake. I've identified a tier one, and in it I put DeSantis and Pompeo and Chris Christie and Tom Cotton, and then I added Tim Scott after last week, and everybody else is in tier two. Of course, that's going to change. We're one third of the way through season one in the Hunt for Red November, but what do you think of those top five?
I think that makes sense. I think people underestimate Cotton. I really do. I think Cotton is probably might be the smartest in the sense of has the best organization, the best organizational mind, is just somebody who understands what it might take. I just get the sense that he's very methodical, as you know, because you know him very well. You've had him on the show about 7 trillion times. But yeah, I generally agree with that.
Well, what I didn't know about Senator Cotton, I sent him a little note saying, how did I not know this? And he sent me back an emoji shrugging arms. And he got onto judiciary. He had already been on armed services and intel, and he kept those two places, and he negotiated himself a seat on judiciary. Well, as you know, Jake, that's the highest profile committee every time there's a retirement from the Supreme Court. That's when America tunes in, and they will tune in when I think Justice Breyer steps down as expected in June.
Yeah, and well, I don't know if he's going to step down. I know that's expected. But yeah, and people, I mean, Cotton is so steeped in the armed services and intel stuff that people forget, obviously, that he's an attorney who graduated from Harvard Law School and knows that realm just as well as anybody else as well. So absolutely. And by the way, going back to Rubio, Rubio has a lot of high-profile committee memberships as well, including intel. So, I mean, where he's the ranking Republican or the vice chair, as it's called in that setting. So, yeah, very interesting kind of set of responsibilities for those two guys.
Very quickly, the Punch Bowl News made a rare misstep this morning, but I'll let you defend it. Lincoln Project puts up a McConnell versus Trump ad on Fox in Palm Beach. All right, the Lincoln Project is in ruins. It's burned to the ground, and there are a couple of people in the basement with $10, and they bought an ad on a local Fox affiliate, and you amplified it, Jake. That is a corrupt and currently being sued adverse work, hostile environment allegations are flying around allegations of looting it. Steve Schmidt's gone into hiding. Why would you amplify such an obviously gimmicky ad?
Well, and I'll answer this as quickly as I possibly can, because taking that all into consideration, something that we do that we always ask for the buy amount, so we understand how large the ad is. Listen, I think it's an ad that is an interesting ad, obviously acknowledging all of the missteps that the Lincoln Project has had. And listen, it's meant to get a reaction out of Trump. We thought our readers and viewers, I guess, should see it because we thought the ad, the editorial itself, was interesting. But you're right. I mean, they are obviously in some huge trouble.
You see, I think it's the equivalent of running a lunatic group from the rights ad at this point, given how pervasively the corruption of that place has been exposed. I just wouldn't amplify anything. But the rest of the newsletter is very interesting. And I want to get to the Liz Cheney stuff. I know I'm a big fan of Liz Cheney. Big, big fan of Liz Cheney, as I am of the vice president, the former second lady, and her sister. I'm the only one, I think, that's interviewed every member of the Cheney family. Is it possible the Republicans would be so dumb as to throw out Liz Cheney from the leadership?
Yes. I don't know that it will happen, but it is possible. Cheney is out of step with the vast majority of House Republicans at this point. And I interviewed her in Orlando last week at the Republican retreat, and I asked her about her primary, and she said she would be happy to campaign on her vote to impeach Trump. That pissed a lot of people off, just to put it bluntly. And that comes after, obviously, travails for Cheney in the conference. So listen, I mean, here's the core of the question. Is the Republican Party about Donald Trump at this point? And yes, it largely is for House Republicans.
Well, you know, you and I disagree on this. We'll have to talk about it next week. I don't think it is. I think that's the Beltway view of the party. But my view of the party is based on 400 affiliates. And I don't think it's exclusively about, he's a large part of it, but I don't think it's exclusively about Trump. And I think Liz Cheney has a huge role in it. We'll see if you're right about that. Jake Sherman, thank you, my friend, from PunchbowlNews.com.
Got its hustlers, the Bowery got its bums. 42nd Street got Big Jim, a walker here, bull shooting son of a gun.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Our Big Jim is Jim Garrity, the indispensable Garrity, as we like to call him, Jets fan, and of course, columnist for National Review. The Morning Jolt is much read newsletter you get every morning from Jim. Jim, before I roast you and toast you and poke you about the Jets, let me first ask you, I did not know about this until this weekend. I want to pay homage to Jack Fowler, longtime publisher of National Review, and really one of the great gentlemen of journalism. What say you about Mr. Fowler?
You know, I knew that, you know, his position here at National Review had kind of shifted around a bit. It was kind of clear that he was heading towards the direction of retirement. But I was surprised by, you know, hearing from Jack himself when he said, this is it, I'm hanging up my hat. And Hugh, you and I are slightly different ages, but I said probably the comparison is like Don Mattingly at first base for the Yankees. Other guys will play that position, but because of, you know, your formulative years, that's who I'm always going to associate. That's the man in the position. So publisher of National Review in my head. We have a terrific, you know, publisher now, Garrett, but Garrett Bukes. But Jack is always going to be the guy who was running the ship, making sure the lights stay on. You know, taking care of issues when a cruise goer would, you know, wander off or something. Every problem conceivable over decades had come across his desk, and he handled it all with good cheer and aplomb and quick-witted. Just an all-around terrific human being, and it's going to be very weird to not have him around. I mean, he'll be around in some capacity, I suppose. He'll still write every now and then. But
you know, what amazes me, Jim, is I only met him a few years ago. I came by NR's offices and had a great chat with him, and then we've shared a platform before. But I didn't realize the disarray in which a magazine's offices typically are, and it really was kind of a chaos central. But there he stood, quiet and steady. The eye of the hurricane, really. And he's had, of course, tutelage under the great William F. Buckley and colleagues with the great Rich Lowry and a star, you know, just a cast of wonderful people who've come through your offices over the last many years. But he's such a gentleman. That's what people don't understand. You don't have to be a jerk to be great at your game.
No, we did a little award ceremony for him a couple of years ago at one of our National Review Institute dinners. And he was moved by it, and he was struck by it. He was like, you know, getting a little weepy-eyed, which is not something you necessarily would expect. But he's just been the guy who everybody else could rely on for, I say, year after year. I really mean decade after decade. I think it's been at least 30 years, if not 40. So, like, he's, you know, again, it's not going to feel like the same place without him, you know, around the office convincing.
Yeah, you know, I was searching my brain for an equivalent on the Indians. It would be Mike Hargrove is the only guy who, and he didn't last decades and decades. Nobody in Cleveland lasts decades and decades. I mean, it's not the Jets or anything, but it's still. Now, let's turn to your draft, Mr. Garrity, because I got to add, you know, you're a political columnist, but you and I share a passion for bad football teams, but mine is now good. In fact, I heard an ESPN announcer saying, boy, the Browns are stacked. They don't have any obvious holes. They got talent everywhere. I almost fainted. How do you like the Jets draft?
Oh, actually, I'm thrilled, and this is not usually the way I react after the draft. I'll get this out of the way, Hugh. You know, the Browns had a really darn good draft.
Yes, we did.
Greg Newsom is one of those guys. A couple of mocks had projected to the Jets. I would have been perfectly happy with him. Seems like a plug-and-play kind of cornerback. And you guys already had a pretty good secondary. Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoa. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You do. I just say J-O-K. Yeah.
There you go. J-O-K, yeah. A steal for where they got him. Great value. He's going to be, you know, again, you guys had a good defensive line and good rushing the passer as is. And Anthony Schwartz, that third guy, he was another one who was projected.
There he went. Yeah. He's gone.
So really three, again, and after the third round, it's kind of much more of a crapshoot. You're hoping these guys turn into valuable contributors in one form or another. But, again, when you have a playoff team, it's one thing for the Jets picking second, moving up a bit. I'm very pleased. We talked about Wilson last time. I'm pretty happy with him. I have high hopes for him.
You don't worry about Justin Fields in Chicago becoming the Lamar Alexander of this draft?
I think Fields would be very good. I do wonder, you know, so you and I do not have to, cannot usually laugh at other fan bases and other franchises.
No, we can't.
The Bears do not really have a great record of developing quarterbacks.
We can agree.
I was going to say, you look back on that 85 team, McMahon was great, and the last thing I'm going to do right now is criticize the BYU quarterback.
You betcha.
But it was mostly, it was Walter Payton and a just unbelievable defense that got them there.
You know, but McMahon was, you know, not really LDS Central. Zach shows up and he looks like the quintessential Utah LDS kid. How's he going to do in New York?
The best comparison I've heard is that Zach Wilson looks like the kid they would get to play Zach Wilson in the Disney Plus movie of his life. He's the little one in a boy band.
He's Captain America.
Never mind can he buy beer. He can't even get into an R-rated movie without his parents. I can do every Zach Wilson looks young joke for the rest of the show. But anyway, look, we went up and we got the best guard in the draft in Elijah Vera Tucker. I'm pleased with that. You know, that was a giant weakness we had, and that's great. And then, you know, the Elijah Moore, great valued with the first pick in the second. It was our first pick in the second round.
You had a great draft. The only bad draft out there is the Broncos. And our vice president for programming, Phil Boyce, he's still crying because the Broncos blew their draft. But the Jets are back in the game. Sale is a great coach. I think it's a new era for the Jets. You'll be behind us for 3 or 4 years, but you'll catch up eventually. Jim Garrity at Twitter. Jack Fowler at Twitter. Thank you, Jim. Get the morning jolt. Come back for hour 3 of the Hugh Hewitt Show. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining me on this Monday. I'm joined by Steve Kornacki, the man in the khaki, who is always on NBC, and he is a prophet on the Kentucky Derby. Bob Baffert didn't even show up. He pulled an Anthony Hopkins. He did not show up for the post-position draw. He thought Medina Spirit was so unlikely to win. But Steve Kornacki, congratulations. You nailed it, friend.
Hugh, thank you. I got to tell you, I have been trying to find the winner in the Derby for years. And I think I picked the right year to finally break through.
My engineer, Adam, said, ask him how much money he won. Now, my boys both bet on, you know, I don't bet on horses, but they both bet on a horse that came in second. So they're not really happy with you, but they didn't watch you. So how much did you take away from the table, or do the better angels tell you not to say anything about betting?
Well, I could tell you, you know, the odds were 12-1, and I put up on Twitter after the race a $100 bet on the horse to win. So I'll let
nice
the folks
day.
At home do the math.
Very nice day. By the way, I didn't see the piece. I did not see. How did you reason to that before we go to politics?
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, so in all honesty, look, 20 horses originally were going to be in the race. I always try to look for a kind of a long shot in the Derby. The one that I liked was a horse named King Fury, and he got scratched the Friday before the race. So we were down to 19. I went back to the drawing board. And I'm a big horse racing fan going way back. It doesn't mean I'm good at picking the horses. But I tell you one thing I have seen happen now, really this is the third Kentucky Derby, where Bob Baffert, legendary trainer, this is his seventh Kentucky Derby win, most all time, he has come to this race several times with not his best horse, with not a horse that anybody's talking about. And the horse, the style of the Baffert horse in these derbies is to go to the front of the race, go to the front of the field, get the first place, dare the rest of the field to catch him. And I saw Baffert steal a race like this 20 years ago with a horse named War Emblem, went to the front, and nobody ever caught him. And I looked at this race, I said, I'm not sure there's a lot of speed here. I'm not sure there's a lot of pace. I think Baffert will get the lead with this horse. And at 12-1, I'll take a chance he just stays there. So that was the bet. And Medina Spirit went to the lead. I mean, you'd say your son's at the 7 horse. I thought the 7 horse was going to pass. I thought Hot Rod Charlie was going to pass. I thought Essential Quality was going to pass. That stretch run from Medina Spirit holding off 3 horses, 3 good horses, and never giving up the lead. It was something to watch, and you should have seen
it. It was a great race. It was a great race, but I don't know anything about horses. And I do not know, Steve Kornacki, how you have time to know about as many things as you know about. I mean, analytics, it's like politics absorbs all my time, and then what I have left over I use on football, and I trust Pro Football Focus. So I don't actually do any analytics. I just borrow them. You apparently do them. So now we have to turn to the draft. PFF gave 2 A-pluses out. The Jaguars got an A-plus, and I think Urban Meyer ran a very good draft for him, and the Browns got an A-plus. What did you think of the draft?
You got your Browns, and you got your guy, Urban Meyer, with the top 2 grades, so you must be happy.
I am.
Yeah, I tell you, I come at it as a Patriots fan. I think I've been on your show before saying, as a Pats fan, I still hope they get Jimmy Garoppolo somehow, but they got Mac Jones, you know, the quarterback from Alabama. I think there was a lot of thought that the Niners were actually going to be the ones who took him. So I think I was pretty happy with the Pats picking him up. I think I agree. I think everybody does on Lawrence right now with Jacksonville, that I think they've got a cornerstone they can really build on. And I've said to you before, I'm really curious. You know, Urban Meyer, obviously just, you know, one of the great college coaches of all time. You know, that shift doesn't always work college to pro. I'm really curious how that's going to play out.
I think he's going to be Pete Carroll on the East Coast. In fact, I think he'd be better than Pete Carroll because he got his QB, who is, I think, Andrew Luck-like. And but Chicago picking up Justin Fields, that's going to be the Lamar Jackson draft equivalent this time. I think he's going to even bloom even in Chicago. Let me turn now to politics. But I got a quick answer, a question for you, Steve. You know, a lot of networks are struggling. NBC's doing pretty good, but a lot of networks are struggling. Would you hire Paul DeBattista to run a network programming? Would you actually say, Paul, we've seen what you did in baseball and in football. You know data. We're a data-driven business. Come give it a swing.
Well, I mean, I as a company man with NBC, I'd say we're perfectly set with everybody we have right now. They're doing a great job, but I get the logic of what you're saying, and I think that's the kind of mind that's good to have anywhere.
All right, let me play you Carville on a different network that's not doing so well. CNN, we have friends over there, but they're struggling. He was on with great host Mike Smirkanish, cut number one.
Now it doesn't hunt on several levels. First of all, it sounds, I call it the fact politics of the faculty lounge. And in my view, if you want to, in politics, you should speak the language of the people. You should speak clear, direct English and address people as they address each other, not like the humanities department at Amherst wants you to address everybody.
So that Carville is saying that people are sick of wokeness. Bernie Sanders shows up with Chuck Todd yesterday, and he says this, cut number two.
No, I don't think so. James Carville can live in his world. I don't think he's terribly relevant to what happens in Congress right now. Here is the story, very simple story, is that right now, for the last 55 years, since Medicare was developed in 1965.
He goes on to think, let's go to the Carville question. Steve Kornacki, is Carville relevant?
Oh, is he relevant? No question. Look, that's somebody with a loud, prominent voice in politics. And I think what he said in the past week when it comes to this, what he calls the faculty lounge side of the Democratic Party, I think he's giving voice to something I've heard from Democrats who are not just James Carville. I think there's a strain of sort of cultural liberalism that's very predominant, certainly in the media sphere, you know, the Democratic blue aligned media sphere, in the institutions. And I think I've heard a lot of Democrats, a lot of folks like Carville, I say more kind of strategist types who are trying to grapple with it. Who see some risk there in alienating voters that they think they're going to need.
Did you look at those Texas results and did you read into them any larger lesson?
So they jumped out at me. Look, I think you probably talked about it, but here's a district that, you know, Donald Trump won by 3 points. the cumulative Republican vote in this jungle primary was 62%, you know, 24 points above the Democrats. So that's a sizable shift. Now, the Democrats will tell you, look, they didn't really, as a national party, they didn't play there with a concerted effort. Texas, everything's going to be torn up in Texas for redistricting, and the Democrats looked at this and said, hey, look, the Republicans are going to get this seat now, then they're going to redraw it right now and make it safe for whatever Republican wins. So I'll, for now, I'll say there's something to what the Democrats are saying on that, but what it does for me is it sets up a test, because you got a special election coming up in a little bit less than a month now in New Mexico, and it's a district that Biden carried. New Mexico won. It's a district that Biden carried by 20 points. And I want to see what happens there.
Oh, good point.
Because if you've got a sizable shift again away from the Democrats there, then I think it speaks to something broader at that point, clearly.
Now, Steve, I am a Commonwealth resident and voter, and Glenn Youngkin is my choice in the, quote, distributed primary that is underway Saturday at 38, 39 locations around Virginia. It is also a ranked voter. I won't, because I'm strategic voter, I will only vote for Glenn Youngkin. I don't give anyone my second vote. How do you even understand this is working? Do you have any prediction at all, given how unusual the system is, seven candidates, ranked order voting, distributed primary? What do you think?
Yeah, no, and it's, Virginia is not the only place where this is new this year, and it's perplexing, I think, everybody. New York City mayoral race, you know, they're going to have a wide-open Democratic primary, and instead of an old runoff, which is what they used to do, it's ranked choice voting. And I've been starting to look through, and I'm sure you have too, the polling on this to try to figure out. I got to see it. I got to just, you know, in crowded primary fields on a large scale, you know, I mean, I've paid attention a little bit. You know, Maine has ranked choice voting, and I saw that cause a little bit of upheaval in a general election. But in a primary where those sort of partisan ideological lines are not so clear, I want to go through this a few times and because I think this is something you're starting to see adopted wider and wider now.
You know, that's the smart take, because I watched the Browns draft, and everyone said Andrew Berry, the youngest GM and the GM of the Browns, would never trade up, and he wouldn't take a linebacker. So he traded up and took a linebacker because it was a second draft, right? You know, nobody knew what he was going to do. And ranked voting, I don't think experts like you can really figure it out yet.
And again, like I said, especially on the primary side and especially in crowded primaries, here's a parallel to what we were talking about earlier. You know, it reminds me a bit of the trying to figure out the Kentucky Derby field. I mean, everybody's got a theory, and you can hear them out, and you can say, that's an interesting case. And then you hear, oh, what if it goes this way? What if the vote, you know? So it's a different dynamic than we're used to.
You know, that's a perfect segment. Begin and end with the Derby. Steve Kornacki, it is always a pleasure. Be well, my friend. Follow him on Twitter at Steve Kornacki. And now on sports, listen to the man. Listen to the man. I'll be right back, America, on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined by Hotline Josh. Josh Krasher of the National Journal. Josh, I'm holding up in my hand, for the people who are watching on YouTube, my Masters 2021 hat. It's a legitimate, honest-to-goodness Masters 2021 hat. It's got the Masters tag. It is a collector's item, I believe, in Japan. And I'm trying to figure out who sent it to me, whether it's my friend Glenn, who was there, or my friend Dick Houser, who was playing his low amateur. There's a note. Oh, this is addressed to Ted Judge H. That means it came from Glenn Byers, who likes to know I am the Ted Lasso of talk radio and Judge Hewitt in Chuck Boxes. So definitely Glenn. Tell me, Josh, did you watch the draft?
I watched the first draft.
What? Something's wrong with your phone, Josh. Something's wrong with your phone. I can't hear you. Are you on a speaker?
Hold on. Can you hear me now?
Yep. We can hear you now, you speaker people. So did you watch the draft?
I saw the first round. I'm a Patriots fan, so Mac Jones going to the Pats, trying to be the next Tom Brady, is a narrative that I'm paying close attention to. But you know, I'm not as into college football as maybe you are, so I don't know half the top prospects outside of the quarterback.
I didn't know you were a Patriots fan. Kornacki was on this morning. He's a Patriots fan, too. There, you know, Bill Belichick ruined the Browns for 20 years, so I'm not really a big New England fan. But he did. I mean, he learned how to coach in Cleveland, and the franchise left because of it. But it had 3 years in exile because of Bill Belichick, so he's never high on my list. But at least you're not a Broncos fan. Smug showed up here and announced last week that he was a Broncos fan, and Steelers fans are never allowed through. But okay, so let me ask you my second question. The Browns won the draft by common consent, and that's because Andrew Berry is the best GM, and Paul DeBattista is the greatest analytics guy in sports. Do you think an analytics guy like Dieter Podesta would reprogram cable television right now? Because they're looking for, as I put it, they're looking for 100% of the 3% as opposed to 10% of the 100%, which is my broadcasting theory. Do you think Dieter Podesta would change their point of view?
Well, you know, I think there could be more analytics could be used in cable news, since everyone seems to be using a lot of very predictable formats and trying to play to their own base. So, yeah, I mean, I was stunned, Hugh, that Paul DePodesta moved from baseball to football, because, you know, I read Moneyball many years ago, and I thought this guy was going to be one of the best baseball general managers. Didn't work out that way, but now he's really, done a renaissance with his own career with the Cleveland Browns.
He's the chief strategy officer. So people understand they're the Haslams, who are the owner. Andrew Berry is the general manager. And Kevin Stefanski is the coach. And they both have their staffs. But there's a chief strategy officer. He just gives input to everybody. I think he would be a great programmer for a network. And Josh, I have not followed it. And I really want to. You're a straight up news reporter. You do not have spin. You're like the straightest news reporter I know. What has happened to network ratings? I read different things. Are they as bad as I think they are over at CNN?
Yeah, well, I mean, CNN and MSNBC in particular, I think all the cable news networks have dropped since Trump left office. And, I don't follow the ratings super, super closely. But, you know, I think there's a real challenge. It's not just cable news. Broadcast news, the morning shows are down because people are cutting the cords and they're using other platforms in order to get their information. And I think it's a crisis, frankly. Like, people are getting their news from different sources. They're living in their own echo chambers, and it's harder to find a shared reality. You couldn't do that in sports, Hugh. I mean, if the Browns are 3-13, you know, no one's going to be saying, "Oh, they're great, right? This is the right track." And unfortunately, in politics, you have these echo chambers where teams can be, parties can be doing self-defeating things, yet you don't get that feedback, the negative feedback, in which they can change and reform. So I think it's a big problem. I agree with you.
And, there's got to be a data set. There's got to be a data set that would do for television what Paul DePodesta has done for the Browns and Andrew Berry has done for the Browns. They used data to rebuild a team in 2 years. It's amazing.
Well, I'm also convinced that, like, you know, that there's a hidden market in politics for the, you know, center right among Republicans and the center left among Democrats, that neither party, both parties seem to be making mistakes that are hurting their ability to compete in general elections. So, you know, I think there could be someone outside the box thinker who basically goes back to the old playbook of the 90s and looks at how, you know, I think there is an opportunity for both parties to look at that broad middle and say, hey, we really could run with it and be very effective in the midterms next year.
Do you remember the old crossfire? Are you old enough to remember the original Pat Buchanan, Michael Kinsley crossfire?
I think I was a little. I remember Buchanan on Crossfire. I think my Crossfire memory is more Buchanan and who was, I forget, was it Begala or one of the newer Democrats?
Well, that was pretty good too. But the original was Kinsley. Best show ever on cable. I mean, I like the McLaughlin group too, because while it was 3-2, it was a good 3 versus a good 2. You know, it was like the playoffs of talk. And the playoffs of commentary, we don't get that anymore. It's like all one team. Except for Special Report and the Sunday shows. I would love to see you write about this, Josh, because you'd bring analytics to it in your own way. The Paul DePodesta of the National Journal is Josh Kroshauer. Thank you, Hotline Josh. Thank you all for listening. Adam, Harley, Ben, Generalissimo, or Lissimo as we call him now. I'll be back tomorrow, America. Don't miss a minute of the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show brought to you by Sierra Pacific Mortgage. For more info, call 888-888-1172.